Good afternoon, book lovers, and welcome to Reader's Delight. I'm your host, Suzanne Craig-Wittick, author of several books and short story collections, as well as editor-in-chief of Dark Winter Press and Literary Magazine. In conjunction with CKMS, 102.7 Radio Waterloo, and the KW Writers Alliance, we endeavor to bring writers and readers together and promote our vibrant literary community. Today is Sunday, July 26th, and I'll be joined today by three talented authors, Allison Gadsby, Crystal Smith, and John Deegan, who'll be discussing their work with me before reading excerpts from their writing. I'll also be joined by Erica and Andrew from Old Goat Books in Waterloo, Ontario, who will tell us what's in a name. And now, sit back and enjoy today's episode of Reader's Delight. First up, I'm excited to have Allison Gadsby on the show. Allison Gadsby, a first-generation Canadian writer and literary chatterbox, currently living in a multi-generational home on Treaty 13 land in Toronto. Author of the story collection Breathing is How Some People Stay Alive, recently published with Guernica Editions 2026. Other short fiction appearing in Literary Heist, Blank Spaces, The Thames Review, The Ex-Puritan, Blue Lake Review, and more. Her novel, Dreams of the Weary, is forthcoming with Palimpsest Press 2028. She holds an MFA from the UBC and a degree in English Literature and Creative Writing from York University. And she's the host of Junction Reads, a prose reading series, and co-host on the literary radio show Howl on CIUT. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's a great bio.
Thanks for listening, everyone who's listening.
Yeah. So I'm excited to have you on the show because Breathing is How Some People Stay Alive just came out. And it's your first full short fiction collection, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's great. Now, how long did it take you to pull it all together?
Well, I've been writing short stories mm-hmm. for 20 years. One of the stories in the collection was a story I wrote in my undergrad, which was okay. probably 20 years ago. And a couple of the other stories I wrote after that. And the majority of them, I'm going to say, in the last 10 years, but editing,
oh, wow.
constant state of editing.
So it's been a fairly lengthy process putting this collection together from beginning to end. Do you remember what was the first story that you wrote?
I don't actually, because I honestly, I have, and I'm not exaggerating, I have probably 100 short stories in my various hard drives. And I didn't know that this collection was going to be a collection until probably 3 or 4 years ago, when I gave myself a kind of deadline. I said, okay, you've got to put something together. You've got to get a book published. You need to do something. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be sitting in this unpublished space for the rest of your life. So I went through all of the stories that I'd ever written, and I kind of pulled together these stories that I thought matched from feeling and from the emotional, evocative thing that I wanted to do. And when it was all together, I think we only ended up taking out two stories mm-hmm. that the editor, not the editor at Guernica, but an editor that I hired, that I paid to help me with this. And mm-hmm. she said, they don't belong here. They just don't fit. And so I pulled those, and then the collection made total sense.
So there's some kind of common themes that run through the collection then that tie all of these stories together?
For sure. And yeah. that again, I credit to the editor, Jane Warren, because she came back and she said, you know, without these two stories, you've got a collection full of kids that are struggling to survive. Mm-hmm. And those kids exist as adults. I hadn't connected a lot of the stories. I hadn't connected any of the stories, I should say. And she was the one who said that a lot of these kids are represented as adults in other stories. So you should think about connecting them in some way. Wow. And that kind of was a light bulb moment for me. And I realized, oh, wow, they are. These kids are, you know, either versions of my own kids, versions of myself as a kid, versions of my brother as a kid. Mm-hmm. Versions of other people that I knew as kids, and the adults were the kind of traumatic iterations of those yeah. kids.
Wow. Well, I have to say a good editor, a good human editor is definitely worth their weight in gold, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful. So the title is Breathing is How Some People Stay Alive. What's the significance of the title? Is it actually like one of the stories in the collection, or is it kind of an overarching
It is a story in the collection,
okay.
And it just sort of came to me when I was reading through it before I'd even started sending it out. I was thinking about titles. They're really important to me.
Right.
I love a great title. And when I was reading the story that is titled Breathing is How Some People Stay Alive, there's a moment where the character who is struggling to deal with the trauma that's come forward in her mind and body of a sexual mm-hmm. assault when she was a teenager. And as she's struggling to deal with that trauma, she's in the car with her husband and he's sighing, annoyingly sighing. And she's like, don't do that. And he's like, what? Breathe. You know, breathing is how some people stay alive. And it's the moments right after he says that, that she recognizes, wow, you know, it's just that easy for some people.
Yeah.
It's just that easy to live. All they have to do is breathe. And for her, you know, she's choking to death on this trauma.
Right.
She can't breathe. Everyone is out there in the world living these regular lives and she's choking
yeah.
on trauma. And so that sentiment, that feeling, that emotional kind of grasping exists for a lot of characters in the book. And so it felt right to take that for the title.
It's a really striking way of capturing that, I think. It's a wonderful metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But today, you're going to be reading from a different story in the collection. Tell us a little bit about that one. And then anytime you're ready, you can go ahead.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate this,
Suzanne.
Oh, yeah.
No,
thanks.
I'm so excited.
There is a world within the story, within the collection that is speculative, unreal,
mm-hmm.
but also present day, where there are humanoids who exist, these fantastic forms, as they're called. And this is one of those stories. It opens the collection. And I've edited it down just for the radio. And it's called The Deal with Roger.
Okay. Anytime you're ready.
Mirabelle wants to learn to swim, but she's been told her whole life she'd just sink to the bottom, and that swimming is not only a risk to her, but to the lifeguards who might have to retrieve her extra-large body from the deep end of the pool. At 6 feet, 8 inches, and 250 pounds, Mirabelle has always been self-conscious. But as the newest partner at the country's largest forensic accounting firm, she learned success comes with hard work and determination. She's tired of being told she can't do something. When Mirabelle was 13 years old, her father bought her Roger. She was already over 6 feet tall, and after her only friend, Shannon, was shipped off to a boarding school for at-risk youth, Mirabelle had nobody. Roger was supposed to be the high school boyfriend, the high school prom date, the boy back home when she was in college, and the husband she introduced to people at work if she ever found an employer who'd hire her. Instead of purchasing him new, her father went to police auctions until she found Roger, a 6'7" humanoid who was erased and reprogrammed for reuse. Where are you going? Roger asks. Mirabelle is afraid to say because he'll want to come and watch her at the pool. She also worries his rage is escalating. He swears all the time, and when they're watching Housewives, he told Mirabelle he'd like to take a Colt AR-15 and kill them all. When he went into fantastic forms for the age upgrade, she mentioned it, and the broken dishes. She also told the technician that he'd started to call her names, which she didn't at all enjoy, even if he was joking. I am here for you, he says. I know that. I'll be back before Survivor comes on, she says. I am here for you, he says, as in, I have nobody else with which to distract myself. Do you want me to press pause? No, I do not want you to press pause. How many times have I told you? You lay one salami finger of yours on me, and, well, you do not want to know. I promise, I won't be long. I spent all day cooking this carbonara for you. Roger lifts the lid on the pot and digs his right hand into the hot linguine. He shakes a fistful of it in her face, and she watches bits of bacon fly around the kitchen. Mirabelle steps back as he moves toward her. Roger, stop. This is not appropriate. He raises an eyebrow and slowly places the remaining noodles back into the pot and stirs it with a wooden spoon. Roger used to apologize when he crossed the line. He used to let her pause his program when she went to work. But he convinced her a decade ago that he could use the time during the day to make her life better. And isn't that what he was for? I'll be back before Survivor. Fine. Mirabelle slips her feet into a pair of flip-flops, and before she walks out the front door, she feels something hit the back of her head. It's linguine, an egg. She leaves without turning around and picks all the bits out of her hair on the way to the pool. Her hips have been bothering her, and her doctor warned if she doesn't lose weight, her hip replacement surgery will happen sooner than later. The swimming instructor is lovely, and the class demographics include all age groups, genders, and body sizes. They spend the first class paddling in the shallow end and practice putting their faces in the water and blowing bubbles. In their second class, they learn how to starfish and float on the surface, which, contrary to everything her father had her believe, Mirabelle does successfully. At the end of the introductory course, they must kick from one end of the pool to the other using a flutterboard. Mirabelle completes it in 40 seconds. She hides the certificate in the glove compartment of the car. In the fall, the manager at the recreation center informs her that her instructor recommended she jump ahead to level 3, which is 2 evenings a week. Mirabelle asks for time to consider. She'll have to talk to her husband. And I've edited out the conversation that doesn't go very well. At the pool, Mirabelle explains to the recreation manager that she can't do the next level. Her husband is busy with work, and she can't be out more than one night a week. Is everything okay? The recreation manager asks. Her name is Teresa. She isn't as tall as Mirabelle, but she's tall enough that when she stands, her fingertips don't touch the desk. She wears a bathing suit under a tank top and blue jeans. Mirabelle enjoys it when Teresa sometimes gets in the water after the adult lessons. Her face is the sort she'd describe as kind. Bright, smiling brown eyes that widen instinctively when she greets Mirabelle or anyone at the front desk. The marionette lines around her mouth don't make her look sad, and she wears her long, salty brown hair in 2 braids behind her ears. She has a dozen beaded bracelets on her left wrist that represent various ocean species she wants to protect from the plastic that's killing them. It's fine. You know, it's just difficult. It only takes one person to ask Mirabelle if she's okay before she starts crying. I'm okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. It's just I've noticed how much you love the water. Your face just lights up in the pool. I can't do this, Mirabelle manages to say. I'm sure if your husband saw you here, he'd figure out a way to make it work at home. Perhaps a babysitter? We don't have kids. Mirabelle takes the tissue the woman offers and wipes the tears from under her eyes. You don't have kids? Then why, if you don't mind me asking, why can't you be out 2 nights a week? Roger doesn't like being alone. Mirabelle sees the surprise, the shock maybe. Why doesn't he come with you then? He can't swim. You couldn't swim last spring and look at you now. He can't swim because... Mirabelle almost says it, but she signs her name on the attendance sheet and turns to leave. Her father said only the most desperate people purchase a humanoid for companionship, and only an idiot would tell anyone they have one. When she gets home from swimming, it's dark. The lights are out in the condo, and when she flicks the switch inside the door, nothing happens. Mirabelle calls out for Roger, but hears nothing. The kitchen light doesn't go on, nor does the lamp beside the sofa. The power's gone out. When she looks out the sliding doors to the balcony, the city is bright. She goes out and bends over the railing to see everyone else's power is on. Roger is behind her, pressing her body against the railing. She screams when her feet lift off the concrete floor. This would be so easy, Roger says. Roger, stop. This is inappropriate. Her sweatshirt strangles her as it's pulled up by the force of him lifting her off the floor. Roger, stop. This is not appropriate. Stop. After she repeats it several times, Roger's smile falls from his face. "You smell like chlorine," he says. Mirabelle ignores him while she crawls inside the condo all the way to her ensuite bathroom. It's a mess. The drawers have been opened and emptied. All the towels are in the bottom of the tub in a foot of water. Her makeup has been opened, and he's painted the mirror with lipstick and eyeshadow. She moves to shut the door, but he's there with his size 14 foot wedged between the door and the frame. "Why do you smell like a swimming pool?" "I started taking swim lessons," she says. "Move your foot, please." "Why do you need to take swimming lessons? Everybody knows how to swim." "I don't know how to swim. My parents said I would be too big to swim, that I'd sink." "That is probably true, but it is just walking around in water." "Can you move your foot, please?" Roger's body responds, but his wires cross, and he jams his foot back in before she can shut the door. The story goes on from there, and she and Teresa at the recreation center plan something highly inappropriate.
Oh, wow. That was, I'm just on the edge of my seat here.
Thanks.
I wish we had more time, honestly, because I'm sure our listeners want to know what happens next as well. Well, thank you so much for reading that for us. That was fantastic. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
I have a website, allisongadsby.ca. Okay. I have a website for Junction Reads, which is junctionreads.ca. And I'm on Instagram. I made my Instagram public a few months ago, which was scary as hell.
Yeah.
And that is aay.jay.gee. And yeah, that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And that was Allison Gadsby. Next, I'm happy to welcome Crystal Smith to the show. Crystal A.J. Smith is Haisla Sim Sheehan and was adopted into the Helsic Nation. She is the proud mother of four beautiful children who are her world. She is a writer, poet, playwright, and activist. She and her partner Raymond Shaw live in Ligwiltuk territory. She has her master's in educational administration and leadership with a focus on Indigenous leadership from UBC. She stepped away from teaching in the colonial classroom to give her undivided attention to her children. She is actively learning and growing in culture and language. Her family has had their first feast in decades in 2022 for the Hislagwila of their son, Glukwalas Galask Shaw. She is now embarking on a journey to learn and understand her Haisla roots and has begun learning Ligwiltuk culture since 2020. Welcome, Crystal.
Galakessa. Crystal Smith Dawayu. Talku Aragitluch Maram de Wilhwadku. Ligwiltuk de Wiltugu. Gisbagwada de Bitigu. So the language I just spoke is Somaliach, and it's the language of the Sim Sheehan people of northern British Columbia. I said that my name is Crystal Smith and that I'm from Tashku Aragitluch Madam, which is colonially known as Hartley Bay, but also known as Skitgat. I'm also from Kitimat, which is Haisla territory, and I've been adopted into the Helsic Nation. I said that my clan is Killawell, and yeah, that's me.
Well, thank you so much for doing that. I'm so happy to have you on the show today.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. And today you're with us to talk about your new novel, your debut novel, Gitwelt. It was recently published in April of this year with the Porcupine's Quill. I think that's through Gordon Hill Press, correct?
Correct.
Right. And it's about an Indigenous woman who loses her sister cousin to the Highway of Tears. Can you tell our listeners more about the book, the characters, and what led you to write it?
Yeah, so Gitwelt is unique in the way that the majority of the characters do not have names. And so the main character does not have a name, and her sister cousin is only referred to as her sister and or her cousin, or her twin. So she's, those are her names. And I think I did this because I wanted the book to be as relatable as possible. So like by not having a name, it could be anybody's sister. It could be anybody's cousin.
Right.
And then I named the antagonist, if you will, very purposefully. Like, I think John Smith, Officer 1492. That's obviously a purposeful name. Like, we all know who John Smith was and what happened with Pocahontas and on the East Coast there. And 1492 was specific because that's when colonization really begun on North America. And then I think I had another officer. Oh, I'm going to mess it up. 14, it was specific date to like when they first came to Canada. Right. So I use those specific numbers and those specific names purposefully to kind of draw attention to our history. Right. And then I also have our Noch Noch. So I have the little people.
The spiritual beings?
Yeah, our Noch Noch are spiritual beings, are supernatural beings. And I also have the Watsa, which are otters. Mm-hmm. And the story behind the Watsa is that they can transform into beautiful beings. And so in my book, I have them as beautiful women because women are being attacked, but they can be they can turn into beautiful men too. Like that's okay. It's not one or the other. And I think I do reference a little bit about the Gilga Omas, like the animals that the grandmothers had spent time with on the mountain, but very briefly.
For any of our listeners who aren't familiar with the Trail of Tears, can you just explain what that is and how it's important in the book?
Oh, totally. So the Highway of Tears is the Highway 16 in northern British Columbia. Mm-hmm. It runs from Prince George all the way up to northern British Columbia. And a lot of Indigenous women have gone missing along that stretch of highway. So much so that I think in 1940-something, maybe 50-something, it was given the name. It was dubbed the Highway of Tears. And so there's walks that happen, there's memorials that happen. A lot of people have tried and continue to, as I have, reference the Highway of Tears and have referenced murdered and missing Indigenous women because it's such a big, very human issue. Like, it's not an Indigenous issue. It's about humanity.
Human rights. Yeah, absolutely.
That so many Indigenous women have gone missing along this highway.
Yeah, and that ties into why maybe the characters don't have specific names, because so many of those women would have maybe still remained nameless today.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Oh, yeah, I love that. That's so interesting. And what led you to really focus and write this book? Was there a certain, a specific thing that happened, or you just have been, really interested
I was frustrated for sure.
Okay.
As a young person, so I'm 35 now, so and I started writing this book almost 10 years ago ish.
Oh, wow.
So I was 25, and so I was quite young, and I was in an abusive relationship as well. Mm-hmm. But I just felt why is this continuing to happen? Mm-hmm. And so it originated as a short story.
Okay.
And I was in a writing program called The Story We Be and it was run by Mia Mir. And she and others in the workshop were like, this is a bigger story. You can't stop writing this. This has to.
Yeah.
And so over the 10 years from that moment, Getwalk grew. And so I, pieced it together through my life events. I had 2 children at the time. Now I have 4. And it's a pretty big endeavor, and I'm really proud of what came. And how it all came together as well. Yeah.
like life's work, right? Are you ready
Totally.
now to read a little bit from it for us?
For sure, yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, can't wait. Anytime you're ready.
Okay. So the section that I'm going to read is towards the end of the book, but I felt called to read this part. So, Tibbin. The trees are growing so rapidly, as if they know they only have so much life on this earth before they'll be cut down and sold. They band together tightly. That's how I know it isn't a natural forest, that this is a logging road. The man I'm with wants to stop around the first bend, but I assure him that there's a beautiful river just a bit further. He's 6 feet tall, light brown hair, clean-shaven brown eyes, and on the heavier side. He's charismatic, wears a nice big smile that irks me. I can see the darkness behind it, the blood on his hands. I wonder if this guy knows who took my sister's life. I'm just wondering really quick, I ask. Have you hung out with my sister before? Have you taken her out? I ask, showing him a picture of her. She looks just like you, but no, I haven't seen her. I don't usually go up this far the mountain. How do you know about this place, babe? Ugh, babe, as if. I go up here with my friends all the time, I say with a smile. It's about 10 more minutes to the river. Really beautiful place. Well, why don't we just stop here and get acquainted? I don't need to see this beautiful place when I have a beauty right here in my ride. Oh, trust me, it's worth the trip. There's a cabin, and we have blankets. It'll be nice. I just ain't into that, babe. This ride has plenty of space, and we're pretty far into the mountain, so no need to worry about being interrupted. Actually, lots of people come up this way to hunt and fish. But at the cabin, if we start a little fire, it gives out smoke signals. You know, that say, don't bother. You know what I mean? Geez, it ain't fair that you guys get to hunt whenever, and us hardworking folks have to wait and go certain times of the year. You Indians and your freedoms, no offense. I say with a bit of a tone. I said no offense. Why are you acting all mad? Just the simple truth. Oh, I'm not mad. I'm just thinking is all. Trying to focus on where the trail is so we don't pass it, you know? Are we almost there? I think I see the ribbon just up there. You see it? Oh yeah, I see it, babe. As I walk the trail, I feel a little afraid. What if the Watsa aren't there? And this guy really hurts me. I don't know much about fighting back. I mean, I took a few kickboxing lessons while in this big city, but I don't think it'll be enough to save me from a man this size. They said they'd be there. They said to close my eyes as I got onto the sand. They said to walk fast when I heard women's voices, and to keep my head down and my eyes closed when I fell. My heart is racing as I approach the sand. I stop and look back at the guy. There he is, tripping over himself. There are a bunch of beautiful ladies here, I say. Sure, you still want to find that cabin? I bet they'd eat you up. Beauties, eh? I love me some beauties. Hell, they can eat me up all they want. I lead him further on. I know he isn't the one. The little people searched his home and found countless tapes and pictures, but none of my sister. I felt hesitant to lead this man to his death, but surely he's caused harm. Countless women in the area have been harmed by him, maybe killed by him, and the stupid police have done nothing. Not even an investigation. Sometimes we need to look for justice outside these colonial laws. I take off my shoes just before the sand, take one last look behind me, and watch him stumble up the rocks. He's a gross man behind a charming exterior. Our woman will be safer without him. My toes hit the sand and it feels like I'm walking home. It's as if the land itself is hugging me, telling me that it will keep me safe, telling me to let go of everything and just close my eyes. I begin walking faster and I brush into a couple of damp bodies. But I kept moving blindly, as I've been told. The sand lifts me as I walk, and I feel like I'm floating. I hear the otters calling him. I can hear their laughter. I can hear his struggling, his anger, his fury, his wails, his yelping, his begging, his screaming, his gurgling. I can hear the otters' songs, their triumph. I've fallen to the ground without even realizing it, just surrounded by the comfort of the sand, our land.
That was very powerful. Wow. Yeah. So much for sharing that. Yeah. Yeah. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Porcupine Quill mm-hmm. has their website, and that's where my book is found. And if you Google the name Crystal A.J. Smith, it should pop up. It should be one of the first things that pop up, along with a couple of other things that I've done. And because as I've said, also that like I'm an activist as well. So there's like mm-hmm. a couple of court cases that I took on and outside of that, there's poetry and whatnot as well. So,
Well, it just goes
it has to be Crystal A.J. Smith
because there's lots of A.J. Smith, right? Yeah, it has to be. Yeah. I was going to say it just goes to show that sometimes short stories make the best novels, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And that was Crystal Smith. Next up today, it's my pleasure to have John Deegan on the show. John Deegan is a poet and novelist with 4 published books and works in several anthologies. His debut novel, The Uninvited Guest, was shortlisted for the 2006 Amazon.ca First Novel Award. His essays and opinions have been published widely, including in Publishers Weekly, The Globe and Mail, The Toronto Star, The Hill Times, Canadian Notes and Queries, This Magazine, and The Literary Review of Canada. He has served on many boards and advisories in the literary and arts sector, including terms as chair of the Book and Periodical Council, This Magazine, and the Canadian Creators Coalition. He holds a master's degree in literature from the University of Toronto. Deegan has worked on behalf of other authors for the past 20 years. He is CEO of the Writers Union of Canada and chair of the International Authors Forum in the UK. His latest novel is Seldom Seen Road, Latitude 46 Publishing, May 2026. He lives, works, and swims 6 months of the year on the north shore of Lake Huron. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Suzanne. This is wonderful.
You must be enjoying getting the swimming in right now with the weather being so hot.
I am indeed. We're in the middle of a heat wave up there as well. So, it's wonderful to,
nice to, have
to
that
jump into the lake every once in a while.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's get right into it. Your new book is Seldom Seen Road. It just came out in May. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
It's a whodunit, and you've described it as Nordic noir. Tell us a little bit more about that and what Nordic noir means to you.
Yeah, so Nordic noir is a kind of a subgenre of crime literature that came primarily out of Sweden back in the sort of late 60s, early 70s, and really kind of exploded with like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and the Kurt Wallander series of crime fiction and detective fiction. You know, it leans heavily on the sort of bare trees in wintertime, isolated cabin, in a cold landscape, all of which we have in plenty here in Canada. And so it's always kind of bugged me. You know, I'm a huge reader. I've worked in writing and publishing for like 35 years. It's always kind of bugged me that Scandinavia and Northern Europe really took ownership of Nordic noir when, by all rights, it should belong to Canada. So, you know, not to get too competitive about it, but I have thought for a very long time that that we need more sort of murder mysteries in Canada that do the same thing as the Northern European ones. Yeah.
Is there something specifically unique to Canadian Nordic noir that differentiates it from Scandinavian Nordic noir?
Yeah, I mean, so they depend pretty heavily on just the sort of barrenness of the landscape. But I think in Canada we have much more isolation just because of the distance. We're a massive country. If you ever get up into northern Ontario, you know, great long distances between human habitation, and a lot of rocks and trees and lakes, and very little else. But also there's the wildlife, which doesn't really come into it as much in the European noir, and we can utilize much better here in Canada. So my book is filled with ravens and bears and lamprey eels and things creepy things like that from northern Ontario.
Oh I love that. When you're writing a mystery, what do you focus on first, the characters or the crime? Like, what comes first for you? Do you think of a crime, or is it that you've got the group of characters that are going to be part of the plot?
Yeah, I'm much more character-driven than plot-driven, which is not to say that I don't think the plot is important. The plot scares me because I'm not a sort of a natural plotter, but I have become one through writing this book. I'm now the kind of person that draws a complete sort of plot and character map to visualize everything that's going to happen. But yeah, essentially, I wanted to start from the family relationship that is at the core of the book and work out from there. So that's where I started.
Oh, that's great. So Seldom Seen Road is the first book in what's going to be the Burnt River Murder Mystery series. Have you already started writing the next book? Is it in the can?
I have. Yeah. No, it's not in the can, but it is now a morning routine before I start on my day job is to get in a good hour of work on that book. And I mean, ideally, when you're doing a mystery series, I say ideally, it's ambitious, but ideally you want a book a year so that you're sort of bringing the readership along with you. So, you know, I got to kick my own butt on this one and get the next one done.
And stay disciplined. That's really good advice for anybody out there writing murder mysteries. If you're planning a series, like, keep them coming for your readership, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know what? I'm doing a tour for Seldom Seen Road right now. Mm-hmm. I'm driving long distances in northern Ontario and visiting lots of the little public libraries up there, which is all fantastic. And the one question I get every single time is, when's the next one coming out? So if I'm not applying the pressure myself, others will.
You've got a ready readership. Well, and speaking of ready listenership, we are really looking forward to hearing something from Seldom Seen Road. So anytime you're ready, give us a little context and then you can start your reading.
Yeah, since it's a murder mystery, I figure I'll start off with the victim. So I'll read from page one, essentially.
Okay.
And this also gives you a sense of the landscape that I'm dealing with, and that sort of wilderness, wildlife theme that I was talking about.
Canadian
as well.
Noir, yes.
Yeah. The raven hops from side to side on the bloodied road. Corvus Corax. She chooses her approach carefully. A passing car forces a momentary retreat, but the carcass is fresh and other birds are circling, carrion eaters all. She'll be fighting them off soon enough. She must get the best bits for herself before then. Food is energy for the battle to find more food. This is her life. There are trees and rocks all around, and above her a thin, curving strip of sky. The road is a slip of nothing in the forest, a hard black river swimming with giant beasts. The road is dangerous, but it feeds her. Whenever she flies across it, there is almost always fresh meat. She hadn't seen the moment of this death. Whatever happened was vicious, the body torn from teeth to tail. But it must have died only a short time ago, and whatever killed it had not stayed around to feed. The small animal's scarlet softness spills from its split container, spreading and steaming in the shadows of early morning. Something is moving, not far from the carcass. It's watching her, but keeping a distance. It doesn't want the food. Still, the raven keeps herself between the watcher and the meal. Her head points to the forest. If the watcher comes any closer, the trees are a leap and a short flight away. Off in the forest, there's a long roar, far away but coming closer. Is it a king? Will it want part of this meal? She tilts her head and takes a quick lunge. She's expert at this part, alert for danger while stabbing bits to eat. Guard, stab, guard. The watcher comes no closer. She takes a chance and stabs and jabs for the dead thing's eye. It will take some work to dig out the prize, but the watcher has not moved, and the roar in the forest has stopped. Paul Robichaud stands straddling the road shoulder and the edge of a shallow ditch. He watches the bird pick out the skunk's eyes and swallow them whole. Stringy wetness left behind. The air around him is thick with the animal's foulness and blood. The smell of blood is so strong he tastes it at the back of his throat. He's been tasting it now for a long time. It's worn a groove along his tongue. It stops his voice in a wet red cough. He wipes a hand across his face, smearing deep scarlet finger trails. The blood is from the bush. He's carried it out with him, brought it here to this raven and this skunk. How is there so much blood? And why is he here on the side of the highway alone and bleeding? The raven tilts her head and stares again at him. He isn't alone. He remembers through the red fog in his brain, through the pain. There's something with him, coming for him, through the bush, roaring and stinking, something he doesn't want to see anymore. The raven stretches her neck and takes a short hop backwards. She's listening now. She's hearing Paul's ragged breathing. Can she hear the footfalls in the forest? Paul's on his knees on the asphalt. The highway is empty, but something's coming through the trees. It's coming for him. It will make sure the raven doesn't get his eyes.
Whoa.
So that's the
cliffhanger.
That's the opening. You get to meet the unfortunate victim who doesn't get much time in the novel, frankly.
Oh, that's very vivid detail. And you must have done a lot of research on it. That's a lot of great observation about the bird as well.
Well, I tell you, I live in Northern Ontario on a little piece of land, and I do a lot of gardening. And while I garden, there is always a raven on the wire above me. I think because it knows that I have peanuts in my pocket, and I'll leave it peanuts. So they're everywhere up there, and they're such personalities. They're full of symbolism. If you look throughout human culture, everywhere, like in every culture, I think has some sort of raven mythology. Mm-hmm. So it just seemed a natural to open with my raven.
So we learned a little bit about the victim. Who are your main characters otherwise in this book?
Yeah, so the victim is a prominent environmental protester in the town of Burnt River. And he unfortunately ends up in the Burnt River. And my detective is an amateur sleuth who is a retired former musician. Who is unfortunately a widower and finds himself alone in the dark woods of later life, and literally in the dark woods because he lives in a cabin surrounded by the bush. And he has no business sticking his nose into a local murder, but he's so lonely and so in need of human interaction that he succumbs to his natural nosiness and becomes an amateur sleuth. He's joined by his cousin, who is actually a highway patrol. So that was Mark Roth. That's my main character's name. He's joined by his cousin, Jeremy Roth, who is a highway patrol officer up there, and his daughter, Stephanie Roth, who is a criminologist at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay. And between the three of them, with the usual family disagreements and interactions going on between the three of them, they work out the mystery of the novel.
And do those three characters, are they going to appear in the series, all three of them? Or
yeah, that's one of the conceits of my series is that it takes three to get through to get through the mystery every time, because they each make up for each other's shortcomings, and I just love the family interaction. I mentioned the Henning Mankell series about Kurt Wallander,
yes,
a great detective in the Swedish tradition. And if you read that series, Kurt has a really a strained relationship with his father, mm-hmm. and that goes on from book to book. And to me, it helps to drive you through the series, is what's going to happen with this relationship. And I sort of wanted the same thing for my characters.
Right. Kind of what you were saying earlier about the characters being more, you were kind of more character than plot driven, right? Creating the character is just the key. Yeah. Well, that was excellent. Thank you so much. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
I have a website, jkdegan.com,
okay.
Which I call the Book and Bird Room. I love birds, as you can tell by the by the raven. And also, if you just look up Seldom Seen Road online, there's been a nice bit of press about it, and it's available direct from the publisher and any bookstore where fine books are sold across Canada.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, this was a great pleasure. Thank you.
And that was John Deegan. And finally today, we have What's in a Name, where we ask local independent bookstores to tell us how they came up with the name of their store. We're fortunate today to have Erica and Andrew from Old Goat Books in Waterloo, Ontario. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So how long has your store been open?
The store itself has existed since 2001.
Okay.
We experienced a fire a few years ago, so we've moved into our new permanent location at the end of August last year.
Oh, wow, that's great. And I was just recently in your store. It's an absolutely beautiful space. Can you tell our listeners how you came up with the name of the store?
Well, actually, personally, we didn't come up with it.
Okay.
We inherited the name, but we didn't change it because we thought that we couldn't possibly come up with something better. But the story of the name goes like this. The original owners, Scott and Michael, were looking for a name for the store. They'd been through a whole list of different names and nothing seemed right. They were sitting at the kitchen table at the time, hemming and hawing, trying to figure it out. And at the time, one of them had a goatee, mm-hmm. and had facial hair, sideburns, long sideburns, gray. They were both graying. And one of their partners walked by and said, "Oh, come on, the two of you look like a pair of old goats." Call it Old Goat Books. So that's the story. However, several years later, somebody brought them in a quote from a John Baxter book, which referred to the term bouquet. In French, a bouquet means a bookseller, a secondhand bookseller. But it also means an old goat. Commonly, a secondhand book in French is referred to as a bouquet, but an old goat. So something that's been battered a little bit, that's lived through a lot, and but is still worthwhile, still going.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So the term old goat actually does mean secondhand book as well, which is sort of a little bit of serendipity there.
Well, I love that. And because you sell, I think you sell mostly secondhand books, correct?
We do, yes.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Well, that is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I know you've just opened up a little event space outside too, haven't you?
We have, yeah. The building that we're in right now used to be Marble's Restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a patio. And we're using that to host author events, book launches, poetry readings, whatever we can when the weather permits. And it's turned out really well. To have a bookstore with an outdoor space like that is kind of a dream for us. It really works well, and it's our opportunity to sort of reach out to the local creatives and say, "Hey, come and use this space. It's your bookstore. It's your space, and we want people to use it." So,
oh, that's fantastic.
Really to have that. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Olgo Books is located at 8 William Street East in Waterloo, Ontario. If you're an independent bookstore owner and you'd like to share how you came up with the name of your store, just let me know. And that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. Reader's Delight airs on the fourth Sunday of every month. Tune in again on August 23rd from 2 to 3 p.m. where we'll be featuring three new writers and another interesting bookstore story. Don't forget to support your local authors and local independent bookstores. So until next time, keep calm and read on.
This is KW Con, songs and music by musicians from Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge, and all of Waterloo Region on CKMS FM 102.7.